my sense is there's only two kinds of towns or cities, and they are growing or dying. And there's very little in between. It's rare for a place to feel static and unchanged for a long period of time. They are either dynamic and growing, and they really feel different than other places that are stuck and declining.
Greetings, friends. I'm James.
And I'm Randy. You're listening to the Passionately Wrong podcast, where we challenge your assumptions, offer some different perspectives, and hopefully help you make better decisions.
Hey, welcome everyone. Welcome to Passionately Wrong podcast with James Bellargeau and myself, Randy Searles. Today, we're going to discuss where do people live and work and why? And I guess I'll start off, and we're not going to relate this to the military because you don't have a choice of where you work and live. But on the other hand, you do have a choice of whether you want to live and work on the base or off the base. So maybe that'll be something we can play with later on. But in general, if you have a choice to work in a big city or live in the country or live in a smaller city or never even leave the home that you grew up into because you still have friends and family and that's where you found your job, that's what we're talking about. Right, James?
Yes. And I would preface this, Randy, by saying one of the biggest cultural shifts in the entire span of human history happened in the last 150 years. For almost all of human existence, most people's time was spent getting food. So hunter-gatherer, growing, whatever, everybody that you knew spent all of their time collecting, growing, or preparing food. And that had a very significant constraint on where and how you lived. That started to change with the Industrial Revolution, and it started to change with the mass production of food, both farming and industrial activity, which had two consequences. One, it meant most people no longer had to or required to spend their time growing and preparing food in order to live. You could go and buy food in a store or in a restaurant. And as a result, or at the same time, all of those people who no longer were spending their time growing and preparing food had free time and needed to earn money. They went and worked in the factories that were springing up in the Industrial Revolution. All of which is to simply say, for most of human history, we lived close to the land. With the advent of the Industrial Revolution, people then did not and were not any more tied to the land. And a huge number of them all over the world. And you see this happening today in developing countries. What does developing country mean? It means exactly this. People moving from being tied to an agrarian lifestyle to the possibility of an urban lifestyle. And there's pros and cons associated with both. But what it means to us in the West and to people in developing countries now going through this, people can choose, and most of them, 80% or so, are choosing when they have a choice to go to crowded cities and urban areas where they have more and different opportunities for work. So that's the basic premise. You used to have to be close to the land. Now you don't have to be close to the land. What it meant was people leaving the land to go to cities to work. All sorts of consequences on that.
Then in the last 4 years, everyone's working from home, so they don't have to work in the city. Internet speeds are higher than ever. Connection, you can connect with the outside world in just about anywhere. And so I don't think it's happening yet, but I think there's potential for the whole shift to move back out in the country, not to make food, but just to be away from the city and the congestion and things like that.
Moving to the city was not only good. Sure, it gave you opportunities for jobs. It gave you opportunities to meet people and to find a spouse who wasn't one of the three people you knew in your hometown. Lots of benefits, but also lots of disadvantages. It's crowded, it's crime, there's pollution, there's traffic. So that when given the choice or the option again of doing it another way, up until relatively recently, prior to the pandemic, people really had to be quite independent and were outliers. If they said, nah, I'm going to go live in the country, that cut them off from opportunities that are suddenly available. And our suspicion, I think, Randy, you and I, from our discussion before this, is that this is going to open up a whole new movement for people to reconsider where they live and why. So that's the topic. Where do you live and why? The other thing that happened along the way with the Industrial Revolution, just to mention it, is we also got really quite good at distributing goods and services, food among them, to wherever people were. You don't need to be in a city to get access to prepared food. There's either a restaurant or a diner in your town. There's Amazon that can deliver stuff right to your doorstep with obvious exceptions and limits. In principle, the location that you're at is not a huge limiting factor on your ability to feed yourself. So yeah, your premise that you actually can much more easily work in a remote location is a correct one. Probably worth putting some numbers on this though, right? How many people are actually working in a profession or a job that allows remote work? What would be your guess? And we'll have to triangulate this a little bit. I have a number in mind, but it's not most people, huh? Right now,
10%?
I think it's higher. I heard somewhere as high as 30%, but it's something, let's say between 10 and 30% of people who are in a job that easily permits, let's say, remote work. We're in the early days, so maybe it'll get easier.
There's a difference between full-time remote work.
Right.
And so I think it's a little bit lower for, hey, I work in another country or another state and I never go into an office ever. I think that's a little lower than the 30%. Maybe I'm wrong.
That's actually an interesting dynamic to put a check mark in and maybe we come back to, which is if you have a hybrid work schedule, which people like, it's some sort of interim flexibility. I don't have to go into the office every day. I can only go in 1 or 2 days a week, which companies like for all their reasons. That places a huge constraint on your freedom to live and work wherever you want. You can't be on the beach in Bora Bora if 2 days a week you've got to be in an office in New Jersey. So hybrid work is not the same as remote work. It's good, eases some of the pressures that come from a long commute, traffic, et cetera, but doesn't open up freedom in the way that this sort of idea of true remote work does. True remote work, I agree, that's probably a pretty small number, 10%. I'm a software developer. I can work anywhere. I'm a book editor. I can work from anywhere.
I think the other, one of the other questions you ask is why? And I think that's a little bit, we've basically just said one of the biggest considerations is where the work is, what job, where the jobs are and what people are doing and things like that. But the other, there's another part of that why, which is what are you accustomed to? What do you like? Where were you brought up? Do you want to continue in that lifestyle or do you want to change it? Like I went out with a girl who grew up in New York and lived in New York City in an apartment. And never, that's where she went. And then one day she went with a friend to the Grand Canyon and never went back. She actually got a job at the diner in the Grand Canyon and became a guide. And she basically spent the rest of her the next 10 years going from park to park and living in the outdoors because that's what she wanted to do. She wanted to get away from the city. Eventually she joined the military. But the military, as I brought up in the beginning, you have pretty much anywhere you go, you have the option to live on the base or off the base. And if you live off the base, you have a bunch of choices as long as you can get to work on time and get to your physical training in the morning. Some people live hour away. Some people live right outside the gate. And the personal preferences usually are lifestyle. Hey, if I live right outside the gate or if I live on the base, I can just walk across the street and I'm at my morning formation. I'm at the gym, the free gym, the free pool, the free hospital. It's all right there for me. And I'm 5 minutes away and there's no traffic because I live on the base, for instance. If you live right off the base, there's tons of traffic, especially in the morning, in the afternoon, and at lunchtime. It's an hour to get on and off the base a lot of times because it funnels you. There's only one or two ways to get on the base. And then if you live farther out, you'll avoid the traffic on like the weekends and holidays. You'll have to drive for a long time to get there, obviously, and that's consideration, unless you really like Audible or something. So it's like, how much time do I want to spend traveling away from my family and to work every day? And do I like being around military families and military people all the time or not? Because that's another consideration. And it's also like I had a soldier that worked for me. He had 4 kids and he was a widow, but he got a free house on the bay in Florida to put his kids up. So why wouldn't he choose that? There's not a downside to that, really. So there's a lot of different considerations, personal considerations besides just work, I think.
And I think all of this presupposes that there is some ability that the individual has to influence this. And so I would say, even if it feels like you cannot, because you have a job and the job requires you to do a certain thing. So I'm going to acknowledge that there's people with greater and lesser flexibility. But even if it appears you don't have much flexibility, the military, you're already describing, hey, actually on base, off base, and that comes with a whole host of issues. Then your friend who lived in New York City in an apartment who, after a trip out west, turned that into her new lifestyle. You can change your job, right? I don't want to make it sound trivial because I know it's not, but I also know many people who really have made a decision to go a different way. I remember a colleague at work talking about his daughter who finished university in an advanced scientific field and went studying abroad and, or not studying, traveling for a month before she was going to start working, never came back, liked the itinerant lifestyle so much that she worked for a month in a diner in Australia to pay for her next month in New Zealand. And I've heard several stories like that. And those are people whose desire of where to live determines where to work. For many people, where to work determines where to live, but it can go both ways as a matter of personal preference. If you want to work in the high-tech industry in the U.S., you're likely going to be in one of two or three cities, right? You're going to be on the West Coast somewhere. You're going to be in one of a few places. That's just the way that it works, unless you're lucky enough to look into a fully remote job. But that's, come back to that. But yes, I agree with you, Randy, and it's a good point to say personal preferences play a key role. My desired addition is to say you can allow your personal preferences to then influence this, maybe even more than you realize. If in the military, at a certain point, you have the ability to have some influence over where you get posted. I think at one point in your career, you said, hey, I'd like to go to Europe. I'd prefer to go here, but anywhere, better to Europe. And that you managed to work that out by being open to the choice of work by virtue of prioritizing place, right? I did something similar. When I first started my career, I was in New York City, living in one of those little apartments, dealing with the noise and the hassle. And then I could tell myself it was exciting and fun, like everyone who lives in New York does, to get through the day. But at some point, I was like, oh man, I really would like to be in Europe again. Is there a way for me to do it? Didn't look like there was a good opportunity at the law firm that I was working with. They didn't have a big overseas presence, and to go there was a setback to your career. So I just looked around and found another law firm that had a very strong international presence and was looking for junior associates to go to their Frankfurt office. And that's what I did. And so I also used work to allow myself to get a living location that I thought would suit my needs. And so one is not as limited in their choices as it might appear at first glance. Even given all the constraints about family, school, housing, career, there's ways to leverage that in the direction of your choosing if you're lucky and if you give it top priority. Here's something else I observed, and I see now. Sometimes the people with the greatest flexibility are retirees, whom you might say, hey, that person doesn't have any flexibility at all. But actually, kids are growing up. If they had kids, work phase is done because they're retired, partly retired. And while it is easy to just stay where you are and to now enjoy free time, I see lots of retirees who are incredibly mobile. And when I say mobile in the world, you don't have to be wealthy to move anywhere in the world. From a Western perspective anyway, your savings and retirement are oftentimes enough to make you very wealthy in other countries in Europe, for example. And so people who were totally average in the U.S. find themselves very comfortable in Spain or in Romania or wherever they might end up. So that's an interesting phenomenon because those people have pretty much wide open flexibility. They can go anywhere. How does a person who can go anywhere decide where to go? How did you decide where to go? How did I decide where to go? That might be interesting for people because we're both not done and are continually reevaluating that calculation, right? If you don't mind me asking, Randy, what was important to you when you were making some of the choices about where to go?
I met a girl. Isn't that the old?
Yes.
I met a girl and followed her to Romania. That's initially. But how we decided to move to Spain was, well, we have an open mind. We know we wanted to move somewhere warmer. We balanced what we wanted. We wanted to be closer to the ocean. We wanted to be able to not too close where we couldn't afford the properties, obviously, and things like that. So we just kind of made a list of things that we were interested in and assessed what was out there. Obviously, we wanted a country that had some civilization. We didn't want to live in a third world country or, for lack of another word, second world country. We wanted to live in a pretty old first world country, which with first world privileges and modernisms. And also, I need an airport because I go back to the States usually once a year, so can't be too far off the beaten track, things like that.
That's an interesting list, and I could probably say that all of the same factors came up in our thought process. So The first thing you mentioned, which I like, it's not that criteria so much as your mindset, which is that keep an open mind. Really good one, because in the desire to make a decision, because uncertainty is stressful, people often limit their choices. And it's difficult to open up your choices by keeping an open mind, at least at first, because boy, that's the whole world, isn't it? But then you start carving it down quite quickly. No third world, no second world. I'd like to be in a first world country. I'd like to have access to an airport. I'd like it to be governed by the rule of law. I'd like to be able to afford a property there. It's great if it can be warm, if that can be close to water. Those are, I think, sensible criteria. Everyone's criteria will be different, but I totally understand all of those. Cost of living on an ongoing basis, the political system, those might be important to you. And then family factors, being able to travel to visit people who aren't living right where you are. That's easier than it probably has been for most of human history. It used to be that if you crossed the ocean, that was it. People weren't going to see you again, maybe ever, right? Never mind a 6-month deployment. That was a pretty big deal. But now, my kids live in Europe and I live here. I don't see them as often as if I lived in the same town. That is true. But at the same time, it comes with all these other advantages. Here's something that also factored into our thought process. And I admit it was a result of me observing, maybe not on purpose. I just happened to notice myself doing it over the years. Every time I went on a business trip somewhere, I would just see how it felt. From the moment I arrived at the airport to traveling to wherever the business meetings were, to staying in a hotel, to any activities we were doing, I would get any just little surface impressions of the place. Is it busy? Are there taxis? Are there restaurants? What does it feel like? And I developed a hypothesis, and it's totally crude and not scientific, but it informs my thoughts on this whole question of where do people live and why. My sense is there's only two kinds of towns or cities, and they are growing or dying. And there's very little in between. It's rare for a place to feel static and unchanged for a long period of time. They are either dynamic and growing, and they really feel different than other places that are stuck and declining. And I think it happens for a lot of these socioeconomic reasons we were just discussing. But how do you like that basic hypothesis, Randy? You look like you wanted to say something.
I agree. In fact, if you do stumble upon a static village, you're probably in the middle of a horror movie of some sort. Probably look around and arm yourself.
Right? It feels wrong. No, but the ones that are stagnant and declining are sad, actually. They are the result of the town or the city having lost competitiveness and young people leaving for better opportunities, or they go away to school and they don't come back. And that has a very noticeable effect, a vicious cycle, if you will. Property values start to decline. Maintenance of infrastructure goes down. There are fewer and fewer amenities, and it's noticeable, right? And if you have a choice then, and we're talking about deliberately creating choice for yourself in this podcast, so people do have a choice and many people are taking advantage of it, you don't go to a decline or a dying city because it doesn't have all the stuff that we just mentioned, things that you would like to do when you're there, occasionally go out to eat or go to a show or something.
I know you just did a little bit through the suburbs and countryside and have seen this more in the States than I have, but I have noticed it in Europe. There's like villages in northern Spain that support the Camino that we talked about in a past episode that are just completely deserted. They're just empty buildings, rundown buildings, and the only thing they have is maybe two or three hostels to support the pilgrims that are on the Camino that are walking through. And there's nothing else there. And there's a grocery store that's 50 miles away, maybe, or something, that everyone, all the little deserted villages, the hostels in those deserted villages, get all their food from. That's it. But that's true in all these Western European countries, in Spain, France, Italy. I don't know how Switzerland is. It's a small country. I imagine that's not really they have villages in the mountains that everyone wants to live in, and they have a high cost of living so everyone can afford it and make sure their houses are nice. I don't know. But these other countries, especially Italy and Spain, seems to have a big problem with people leaving the countryside. As you said, no one needs to grow the food anymore. We do, because Ukraine's not shipping it anymore. But once we fix that problem, and they're going in the cities where all the young people are all going to the cities where the jobs are.
People think it is the disruption of global trade as such that's going to be most disruptive. I don't think so. I think while that would be disruptive, we could survive not getting cheap electronics made in China what would be much harder to overcome and would radically reshape society again in short order would be the problems in the delivery of food. I don't think people realize just how much food supply is also old. In the U.S. and in large parts of Europe, they are self-sufficient and can grow enough food to sustain their populace, but it would be a very different picture in other countries, depending upon the way things go. So that's something to watch, because as we started this episode, we talked about that being a humongous reason for the shift in people's ability to spend time thinking about where they want to live and what they want to do. It's because they don't have to spend their time preparing food, but that could change, and it could change quicker than people think, even in our modern times. So yes, that's something to watch and a reason not to be completely cavalier about your concerns about the world stopping at the borders of your country, because your country actually has connections to others in ways that you might not appreciate. At least it's worth keeping in mind. So yeah, it's a good point, Randy. And just to answer your question, yeah, Switzerland actually, despite it being tiny and people being able to afford living most anywhere they want, also has a few abandoned and dying villages up in the mountains mostly that are remote and hard to get to. And even big cities, though, I think this phenomenon also holds, have this sense of they're either growing or they're not. For us, you know, that growth is partly something that I think can be steered and can be directed. It certainly can be encouraged, let's put it that way. One of the reasons that we came to this small South Carolina town that we live in is because they had a 20-year history of excellent cooperation between local city government and private parties, businesses, and people interested in culture. And they really had a demonstrated track record of saying, we know quality of life is important. We see that this and this influence it. We'd like to live in a place that people like to live in, and therefore we're going to do these things. And by the way, we're not done. We have a 20-year plan to keep doing them. That sort of open and public acknowledgement that choices that leaders make and that citizens make in their community actually influence how nice it is to live there. Believe it or not, that's not something I see everywhere. A lot of times people just take for granted, New York City is great. It's always going to be great. What's the big deal? We don't have to worry about traffic or crime or pollution or noise. Actually, yes, you do. So those were the kinds of factors that I kept in mind when I said, at least personally, I feel like places have a different feeling, like they're growing or they're not growing.
I think that brings us to the end of our episode. What people are passionately wrong about is that everyone's going towards the cities, but that might change in the near future if it isn't already changing right now, with maybe some food shortages and also the ability to work at home and things like that. There may be a flip around. We'll see.
And I don't know if people are passionately wrong about it, but at least if they aren't thinking about it this way, that they should be more optimistic that they can exercise influence over their choice of where to work and where to live exactly for these sorts of reasons. And so if you're not thinking about it that way, go ahead and do.
Or buy a village in Italy or a castle.
Dane. All right. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone.
We'd love to hear what you think. So please comment on the show with your thoughts. We read all of your comments.
Thanks for joining us. And thanks for subscribing. See you next time.
You've just listened to the Passionately Wrong podcast with James Bellargeau and Randy Searles. If you like this episode, follow us on your podcast platform or subscribe on YouTube. Join us each week to help you make better decisions by challenging your assumptions. And check out all our episodes at passionallywrong.com.